from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. For gearheads, Monterey will be heaven on earth this weekend. The Pebble Beach Concours, the Quail, Concorso Italiano. I don't have time to list all the events. Whether you love cars, I mean really love cars, or just love someone with a condition, it's time to polish your positions on everything from the price of earplugs to the difference between old and new automobiles. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour, if you're an obsessive automotive enthusiast, you're either listening to this show from Monterey, planning to be there this weekend, or perhaps wishing you were. For those unfamiliar with the beast, we're not talking about one classic car event, but a collective celebration of the fact a surprising number of rich people buy respected but rusting cars, spent a mint to restore them, and then in some cases take them out on the racetrack and floor the gas pedal. Let's welcome now Dan Gurney, former international race car driver and chairman of and CEO of All American Racers. He's hopefully going to join us later this hour by phone. It's worth pointing out that this year's gathering celebrates the career and cars of Dan Gurney, who is a legendary American race car driver. Also with us this hour, Bruce Canepa, of CEO of Canepa Design and Concept Transporters. He's also on the executive board of Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. And Dutch Mandel, editorial director, associate publisher of Auto Week magazine and AutoWeek.com. Let me just quickly ask our producers if we've got David Love on the phone as well from the Classic Sports Racing Group. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me start, I guess, with Bruce Canepa. You know, for the benefit of people who may be listening to the show who are not passionate about old cars, what makes an old car valuable?
Well, I think its history makes it valuable, and cars were built different in the old days than today. Today, everything's really done with computers and rapid prototype tooling, et cetera, et cetera. And old cars were built with hands, and the engineering, a lot of it was out of somebody's head. And there was a lot more identity in cars back then. So, you know, the Italians built cars, and they had a certain character and design and sound and feel. And the Germans were different, and the English were different, and the Americans were different, and very different directions on what cars looked like and how they were built, and their construction methods, etc. So, you get a lot of diversity in the cars. You get a lot of identity with the cars, And, you know, they were really artistic in a lot of ways because there was so much handwork done in building race cars and road cars in the old days.
Can you give us an example? Let's say the most expensive car you've ever restored.
Right now, as an example, we're restoring the first Duesenberg ever built. It's a car that was built in 1922. It's owned by the same family in its fourth generation in the same family. And we are completely restoring that car, and it will be done by next year for the Pebble Beach Concourse. But you know, it was the very first road car to have hydraulic brakes. It's a car that had a completely one-off body design. As it happened, the owner, who was Jim Castle Sr., which was original founders of Dole, the Castle and Cook Food Company. He was 7 feet tall and weighed almost 300 pounds in 1922. And so this car was totally custom built to fit him. And of course the Duesenbergs were building race cars, so it has an eight-cylinder Duesenberg Grand Prix style or race style engine in it. So, That's one of the most valuable cars we've ever had here to restore.
And there's really nothing else like it in the world.
There is nothing like it in the world. The fact that it's number one on the chassis and really the fact that it's belonged to the same family for four generations is pretty rare.
Dutch Mandel of Auto Week, you've been to this thing a number of times. There are actually, depending on how you count it, 16 to 19 different events on the Monterey Peninsula. Do you have a favorite?
I don't think you can have a favorite. That's like asking if a parent has a favorite of a child. I mean, I want to go back a little bit, Rachel, to what you said. You know, what makes these cars valuable? I would argue that it's not all rich people who are putting in the effort and the time and the money. It's people who have the passion for the car, and that's what makes them valuable to people. People are buying these cars because they spur memories. They buy these cars because of something in their past or because it was driven by their hero. So to ask what is the one favorite event is akin to walking into the Willy Wonka chocolate factory and saying, okay, if you could have one piece of chocolate, which one would you want?
Is there anything in particular special about this year that you think is worth pointing out?
Are there any one of a number of special things? I wouldn't discount the people. And when we get Dan Gurney, he is as much of a treasure as that Duesenberg that Bruce is restoring. He was an American who built his own Grand Prix car and won a Grand Prix race with that car, which has never been done before. So the people make it all just really fantastic. We have Alfa Romeos. You'll see Alfa Romeos, these live Italian beauties, in numbers that you can't even imagine. There's the Concorso Italiano, which is about and celebrates Italian marks from Ferrari, Maserati, Lamborghini, all of them. I am a particular fan of the Quail, which is a motorsports-focused Concours. But you can't go wrong with Pebble Beach, the granddaddy of them all, because you're going to see cars there that haven't been shown to the world and are seeing, you know, the sun for the first time in public. It's amazing.
Well, speaking of Ferraris, David Love, a local owner and enthusiast who has built a special garage for his Ferrari Testarossa, a model that sold in Italy last year for more than $12 million. And the car that I take it you race?
Yes.
How do you live with the potential heartburn
It's inertia. I've had the car for 46 years, and I've driven it all the time. And there's something about it that you can't really put a price on. I think Bruce said it very well. We're talking about how do you value your oldest child. I mean, it's not really a matter of what you can sell it for, because you either have a check for $1 zillion or you have a nice old car.
You crashed a Ferrari 250 TR at the 2009 Monterey Historics. You must have quite a stomach for risk.
I don't think so. I think it's just habit. The car is an easy car to drive, and I've been doing it a long time. And as I demonstrated so completely this last week, last event at Laguna Seca. Anytime you put your foot in one of those old cars, there's a chance of making a mistake, and the consequences of that mistake could be way, way out of proportion to what created it. You play tennis and you make a bad move, you can break your ankle. You get in one of these old cars and not pay attention to what you're doing, and you can kill yourself.
Dan Gurney is now on the line with us. Thank you for joining us, sir.
You're talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Oh, hi. You're Rachel, right?
I'm Rachel. I understand you are a legend in the business, and I wanted to ask you a really simple question. Who taught you how to drive?
My mother. And it was an interesting little thing. I broke my arm playing backyard baseball when I was about 9 years old, and sort of caught my foot on a stay that was holding a tree in position, and fell over. My elbow broke the wrong way, bent the wrong way, and it ripped up the joint in the elbow, and So I was going back and forth to the doctor for many, many months, 9 months, really, and sitting next to my mother, and she let me drive. First I was steering, then I was using the gas and the brake, and when I finally got to drive the car, it felt strange because I was sitting right behind the wheel, not what I was used to, sort of sitting next to Mom.
So pretty soon she had you picking up the groceries?
Well, I could think of all sorts of excuses to drive the car. The family car at that time was a 41 Chrysler, I forget the model, but anyway, one of the things I did, because I was already smitten with racing, is I'd go to the drugstore and buy castor oil and then take the air cleaner off and pour it down the carburetor. And it smelled just like the midget races when... So anyway, I used to wash the car a lot so I could drive it.
What is the fastest you've ever driven in a car, and which one was it?
Oh, probably an Indy car, and it's only about 215. And we went 213 in the 67 Le Mans winner that A.J. Foyt and I drove back in 67, but that right around there.
You know, it's probably impossible to explain to somebody who hasn't done it, but what does 215 miles an hour feel like?
At first it feels pretty fast because things are appearing and going by pretty rapidly, but you get acclimated to it, and pretty soon it's just, you know, you're going fast, but you have to drive and concentrate on what is happening pretty far ahead in order to be able to do something about it, if it meant that you should change what you're doing. And but you get used to it, and then it doesn't seem so fast.
There are streetcars now that are faster than a lot of the early race cars. I'm wondering if you can talk about the special challenges of racing early cars, classic cars.
Well, classic cars are subject to age just like human beings, so they're quite not, maybe not necessarily as reliable as they once were, but gee, if you look at the era that came before I was born, why, people had flat tires all the time, and nowadays that sort of thing is a rarity. Anything that'll go fast means that you better pay attention and sort of try and anticipate what's going on, where you're going to be in the next few seconds, that sort of thing.
How would you like to see young people today trained to drive? Is there anything you see on the roads these days where you think, you know, something should be done about that?
Well, I'm not a big fan of people lollygagging along, talking on the cell phone. And it used to be the roads were a little more disciplined. If you wanted to drive slowly, you should drive on the right side of the road. But that discipline seems to have disappeared along with the old 1970s gas crisis. But I'd say that anticipation is probably way more important than reactions. And you should drive accordingly, and an indicator, if you're not paying attention, or every once in a while you have a sort of an emergency, it means that you haven't been predicting what's going to happen ahead of you, or anticipating what's going to happen ahead of you, and you should maybe look even a bit further ahead and try to analyze the situation all the time.
Now, you've traveled all over the world racing. How does Monterey stack up?
Well, it has a special character. The corkscrew turn is probably now famous worldwide. I think I'm a motorcycle fan as well as cars, and the motorcyclists generally feel it's a very difficult place to ride, but it's a huge challenge. And as a spectator, I love to go there, and I think it's a great racetrack. Depending on what you like to see, you can almost see anything you want to see there.
Anything in particular you'd recommend making a point to check out?
Well, usually I try to walk around, although walking isn't quite as easy as it used to be, but and try different places. You can turn 5, I think, is an interesting one because they're going very fast and they have to brake for a left-hand turn. One of the turns that's difficult to get to is the one left turn after a bridge going and then goes up the hill in the back there before the corkscrew. That's a very interesting turn because there's a lot of touchy braking involved in getting set up for the turn, and it's a difficult one. I don't know. It depends on what kind of a student of racing. I often watch it from way up on top, and yet you can be above on the outside near the start line, and that's very interesting.
Well,
it's all very good.
I don't want to hog Dan Gurney here, so I put it to our panel. Do you have any questions you want to ask? But since everybody is a guy on the phone, just make sure to identify yourself.
Hey, Dan, this is Dutch Mandel. How are you?
Hey, Doug. I'm fine, thanks.
Good. What do you think of being feted as a legend here at this weekend's event?
Well, you know, I, of course, all the old cliches, I think it's wonderful and so forth, but I never intended to reach for it, and yet I was thinking I have a severe case of the automobile age virus, you know, and so I feel fortunate that I've been involved in the many decades of automobile racing, but I'm just an automobile fan, and that's the reason that I end up being in this position, and we're hoping that we're going to see a lot of our former employees and drivers and builders, and it's just a great occasion, and I appreciate it very much.
Let me ask you, Dan Gurney, another question. You know, this being California, we're all pretty excited and focused on some of the alternative fuel vehicles that people are developing, getting ready to throw out on the market. What do you make of this switch away from fossil fuels? Is there anything that particularly piques your interest, or do you find it lamentable?
I very definitely feel interest. I tend to be on the side of the low-cost energy, but I'm also very interested in the freedom to come up with alternative sources of energy. I'm part of the gasoline age, I guess, but I'm not negative about the other alternative fuels. I think it's great if we are able to provide our own fuel needs or a big percentage of it. And I'm sort of from the drill side. I want to explore for more petroleum products or gasoline and so forth, diesel, and I hope that they're going to come up. I guess if it's a finite resource, you ought to have something for when it finally fades away because it's all gone. But so far, it's pretty hard to see that position, and I think there's a certain limit on how much taxpayers should be encouraging it with their own money.
But I take it you'd be available to try out any prototypes that companies want to take your way?
Well, it depends. If they want to use it as an endorsement, probably I'd want to think about it very carefully.
But, you have to drive the car first, obviously.
I'm curious. I've always been curious.
Dutch Mandel, is there anything of that ilk that is going to make its way to the Monterey Historics this weekend that people should make a point of checking out?
Anything that's going to be of an alternative fuel?
I'll probably say prototype. You know.
Something that's steam powered, perhaps, if it's going to be historic. I can't anticipate. I don't know what will be coming or what will be sitting in the parking lot. There's always that's the great thing about this weekend in and around the Northern California Peninsula is that you will see Manufacturers make it a point to bring cars that are prototypes, that are you might see a Chevrolet Volt just sort of wandering around, and they're going to gauge consumer reaction. But I wouldn't anticipate seeing anything at the Monterey reunion that is a current alternative fuel vehicle for another, 40 or 50 years. Isn't that right, Bruce? I mean, that's...
Bruce Canepa,
I think it'll be a while. I think the only alternative vehicles you'll see this week are guys using things like methanol and other gasoline blends. That'll be about as alternative as it gets.
Bruce, you've seen a lot of people come in, I presume, rather sheepishly with priceless classics that they've managed to destroy, either at Monterey or at some other location. Have you become a kind of automotive therapist over the years, restoring those cars?
Well, actually, there's not many cars that are destroyed, and there's some accidents because you're racing the cars, you're not just cruising around in them, but... You know, as David said earlier, I mean, he's raced his car for 46 years, and then he had an accident, and you're gonna have an accident at some point if you're gonna drive him aggressively. But it doesn't destroy him. I mean, they've been wrecked back in their day in the beginning, and they'll be wrecked again. And for the most part, everything is repairable. And with today's technology, things that weren't repairable 20 years ago are repairable. So. And the value is separate from the repair. I mean, the repair cost is not related to the value of the car, typically. I mean, if it takes X amount of hours to fix something, whether it's on a car worth, $10,000 or whether it's on a car worth millions of dollars, it's really the repair costs are pretty similar in terms of labor. So, but we don't really see many wrecked cars. Most of the guys drive the cars as aggressively as their capabilities are without running into somebody else or without taking the car off the road. There's not a paycheck at the end of the race when you get the checkered flag here. This is about having fun. This is about having spectators and the fans get to see these cars moving rather than static, because you can look at a race car static and it's a beautiful piece of design and human effort. But when you see it moving and you hear it and you smell it, it's entirely different. It takes everything to another level. And
Dan,
that's what the reunion is all about.
Dan Gurney, you're building a motorcycle called an alligator?
That's correct. That's one of the things I've noticed after leaving automobile racing, why there seems to be more freedom to design and build motorcycles than there is even racing cars today. But the alligator is alive and kicking, and we started out with a single-cylinder bike, and we built several of those, Honda-powered and also one with Yamaha-powered, but we're working on an S&S Harley-style engine, a 45-degree V-twin. And that's coming along, and it's looking very good. And we're trying to build something that's going to be quite capable.
Well, with that said, I want to remind our listeners we're talking about the Monterey Historics. We'll take a short break and come back. We want to hear from you. Come join the discussion at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. What do you want to ask these gentlemen? Give us a call. Let us know. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This weekend, the quiet sound of the surf and songbirds that reigns over Pebble Beach will be overtaken by a motorcade of vintage cars and motorcycles that run with all the smoothness of a row of machine guns. Well, some of them anyway. We've got a number of guys here to talk about what's happening this weekend who are legends in their own time, especially Dan Gurney, former international race car driver and chairman and CEO of All American Racers, a race car manufacturer, David Love, a classic race car enthusiast and co-founder of the Classic Sports Racing Group. David Love, you didn't get a chance in the last half hour to ask Dan Gurney any questions, so I wanted to give you that opportunity right off the bat.
Well, I've just enjoyed sitting here and listening to everybody who knows something talk.
Along these lines, I want to encourage folks who are listening to the show to call in as well. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org. We were talking before the break about a motorcycle called the Alligator. Dan Gurney, why Alligator?
Well, it's actually a little bit lower than most bikes, and it's a little longer than most bikes, and it hopefully it's not as ferocious as an alligator, but it actually, from the standpoint of, say, a moving object is going through the air, if it's smaller frontal area, why it should be more efficient. And so it's got a low center of gravity, a smaller frontal area, and it's just a great deal of fun to ride. Now, the name Alligator is, when you think about it, if it's pretty low to the ground and pretty quick when it wants to be, of course, our alligator doesn't have teeth, but you want to be careful of it anyway. So, but that's where the name Alligator came from. A former machinist of ours who passed on, Jerry Whitfield, came up with that name. And when we heard it, we said, yep, that's it.
It does seem like for people who are in love with classic cars, with classic motorcycles, that it's not just a question of riding them or racing them. It's also a love of building them.
Well, that's true. And, Lord, there's been an awful lot of people with enough to go for it and try to come up with motorcycles, probably thousands of them worldwide, different types, and it's fun to be part of that same type of people who have that love of a two-wheeled vehicle. I certainly am one of those.
Well, let's go now to the phones. Kurt in Berkeley has got a question.
Hello.
Hello.
Mr. Gurney, it's an honor to have a chance to speak with you a little bit. I grew up in a family of sports car racers and enthusiasts and worked professionally for a few years in my earlier life and
thank you,
followed your career throughout. At this stage of American formula racing, open wheel racing, what do you think it's going to take to get us out of the era of spec car?
Well, I'm a big sprint car fan, but to try and answer your question, I think it's going to take a necessary amount of money and a necessary amount of international passion, and I think that it could happen at any moment still, even though we've seen a few false starts. It still is, you'd think that the United States could come up with as much as some of these other countries have done. And I think, we'll see. I still hope it can happen sooner rather than later.
Dutch Mandel, can you give us a little bit of context for what these gentlemen are talking about?
Well, it's one thing. It's one thing to have all manufacturers race against each other. It's another thing when a sanctioning body wants to make racing entertainment. And something that we've seen in NASCAR, for instance, is a standardized chassis and body shape with decals of manufacturers and essentially the same specifications of engines. We're seeing that in formula cars, and the only place really that we see it is in Formula One now, where that's not the case. But of course, Formula One is identified as the ultimate in technology. Of course, they've got constraints, but it's also the ultimate in terms of cost. I mean, it's something on the order of $400 million to campaign a season in Formula One, and that's ludicrous.
because it, I mean, there's practically aircraft engineering in there, or there is aircraft.
Oh, it's beyond aircraft. This is spaceship stuff. Absolutely.
Well, with that, thank you so much for your call, Kurt. Let's go now to Ken in San Francisco.
Hey, I'm a huge fan of the old Trans Am car series of the late 60s and 70s. And when Mr. Gurney was driving things like a Boss 302 Mustang in 1969, a Plymouth AAR Barracuda in 1970, when did stock cars stop becoming stock cars from the factory and become these plastic-bodied, hand-built exotics? I mean, when did it really leave the reality of cars we would see in the showrooms and become these hand-built things that could really have any body on them? They make them look like Chevys or Fords or whatever, but they're all hand-built exotics. I love the days of the old factory cars.
Dan Gurney, do you want to take that one on first?
I can try. I think somehow, if you say that the automobile industry has finite amounts of money that they can spend to try to help sell cars, that the world of marketing took over, and it sort of overwhelmed win on Sunday, sell on Monday, the racing car mantra, and that was a decision probably made by corporate heads that weren't necessarily involved in racing, and but they had enough weight, so that's the way they decided to go. So the manufacturers pulled out, and the racing people had to do something, and in NASCAR's case, they came up with what is now the car of the future kind of thing, and to avoid being left high and dry by the manufacturers.
Bruce Canepa, you want to add to that?
Well, the other thing that happened too is if you look back at Trans Am in the 60s, the late 60s and the 70s during that era, because it really Trans Am ran from about 67 through 71 or 2 in its heyday, and Dan drove several cars in that period. You had cars that you could purchase and convert to a race car. By the late 80s, cars were front-wheel drive and different engine configurations, and it really weren't very appropriate to building one of those cars into a race car. So at that point, either the manufacturers and or the private teams had to kind of build a car from scratch, so to speak, whether you started with a bale of tubing or whether you started with an aluminum monocoque. You had to create a car because you didn't have a basis to go buy something off a showroom and convert it to a race car.
And let's also remember, sorry if I might, this is Dutch just jumping in here. It was, and you're right, Bruce, with the heydays of the Trans Am, we had our first oil crisis in 73, and cars became anemic. And you know, it was in bad form to go racing and burning fossil fuels willy-nilly in sport. So when the love of racing came back, they tried to rationalize it in price and in specifications.
Do you think there's room for racing in a new world where fuel efficiency is paramount in a way it didn't used to be?
Well, and it's happening. This is Bruce Canepa again. It's actually happening because in most forms of racing, the sanctioning bodies and the designers and builders of the race cars are looking for ways to make the cars more efficient as it relates to the use of fuel, et cetera, whether it be Indy cars using an ethanol blend or Formula One with KERS systems generating energy. Most forms of racing are looking at ways to make the cars more efficient at this point.
And the ALMS is also celebrating those cars and manufacturers that are either running in with a greater percentage of ethanol or using diesel. So I think to answer your question, Rachel, yes, there is a place
for racing. As it was said, the first race started when the second car was built. There will always be racing. It's just whether or not we want to hear the rumble of a V8 or the whine of a V12 or the whoosh of an electric car.
Well, with that, a quick translation of ALMS, American Le Mans series, and now on to Chris from San Francisco.
Oh, hi, Mr. Gurney. It's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
I have a question. It's not about race car driving, but it's about sailing. I'm a sailor here in the Bay Area, and your name has come up in respect to designing a sailboat or several sailboats. I'm wondering how you got involved in that aspect of design, and what was your background?
Well, I don't know. I've always been interested in getting through the air efficiently, and I did come up with a flap that seemed to help in certain areas. But I don't know. I mean, racing is an efficiency contest, which no matter how you cut it, if you're more efficient in the racing business, you've probably got a much better chance of winning the race. But no matter what you're depending upon to be efficient. Our producer
Kevin says the ideal is to end the race and run out of gas at the same time.
Well, that'd be good if you could cut it that close. But that would mean that you haven't carried any extra weight with you. But in the end, that's more of a coffee table talk than anything else.
Well, with that, let's move on to Michael. Gary in San Jose.
Good morning. I'm going to sound like all the other guys, as I can tell. We're all the same generation. We all grew up loving the race cars of the 60s that you could relate to, that it looked like something you might actually drive. And when it had a manufacturer's name on it, it actually meant something. So again, I'm honored to talk to Mr. Gurney. I had a question for you, Mr. Gurney. I was always a big fan of, while I'm driving my Porsche, I was always a big fan of the Ford race cars of the 60s, the GT40s. And I know you've raced them quite successfully. What was it like to be driving one of those cars in a 24-hour race? It had to be just emotionally and physically draining and exhilarating all at the same time.
Well, in those days, I don't know why, but we never felt it was physically draining. Maybe we were driving too slowly, but in any case, that car was a very comfortable car. It was more like an American road car than a race car from my other racing experiences, and it was a terrific thrill to be able to drive with Americans in Europe or other parts of the world and just sort of be an ambassador in a way, and I loved every moment of it, and the Ford GTs were terrific cars, and I think that they were dominant for quite a while in long-distance endurance races, and we're very proud of that.
Thank you.
You know, I want to follow up on Gary's point earlier that it's kind of a generational thing, that men of a certain age are into these cars. Given that there was this massive oil crisis in the 70s, does that mean that this whole field of passion dies out at a certain point?
It better not. I think it'll put me out of business if that's the case.
I don't think it will. I don't see that ever happening.
There's always going to be somebody to sort of pick up the ball, the next Jay Leno, a big pocketbook.
I think we're obliged to pass on the passion. It's handing down the torch, but you take a look at 3-year-old boys. They will pick up sticks and play army, and they'll make racing sounds regardless if they see a car. So the same thing with girls. So it's not a gender thing and it's not an age thing. I think it's just an appreciation for the beauty, as Bruce said, and the power and the efficiency, as Dan said, and as David said. He's had a car for 47 years, and I imagine that he remembers virtually every day with that thing.
Let me... go ahead.
All right, just identify yourself, though, first.
This is Dan. I'm trying to inject something there.
Go ahead, Dan.
I've thought about it a bit, and really, when you think about the car and it dying, possibly, or racing, I've often thought of the car as close to a magic carpet as you can possibly get. And that today's automobiles, all you need is the key, and you're ready to, and some of them you don't even need that, the combination, but anyway, the key, and you can go almost anywhere you want to go. You expect to be there. You don't expect to have to do a lot of maintenance on the way, and it's just a fantastic, almost underappreciated thrill that is here today, and I think it should be pointed out.
Well, along those lines, I wanted to interject here with an interview that was conducted with a very excitable two-year-old. His name is Miles, and I think this goes some way to explaining how deeply buried, how primitive the passion for cars really is.
Beep, beep.
So I think there are a lot of listeners out there who are going to recognize this passion in their own kids and see the future in that set of sounds.
Sounded like a 10-cylinder.
A 10-cylinder.
The BRM16 there, Dan, I think. Yeah, the passion is there. The passion is handed down in generations. It is a magic carpet ride, and the cars deliver the fantasy, and that's actually what we're trying to do too. Right? Whether it's Bruce in recreating it and recapturing that, or David with his racing, and us with writing about it online and in a magazine.
Well, you know, I wanted to move in a slightly different direction as we start to round out the hour. There is some controversy about new management for the racing this year. I know that's something that you have pretty strong opinions about, Dutch Mandel.
Well, I've had strong opinions about it. I think that I've mellowed with age. I am sort of a traditionalist. No, I am a traditionalist. And Steve Earle, 35 years ago, I think it was, founded something, came upon a recipe for success in creating the Monterey Historic Automobile Races, and gathering a bunch of his friends together who just had some really great old cars. And it was...
David Love had one of them, I believe.
It was without question. But, you know, they were old boxes. I mean, these were cars that were no longer competitive on the track, but they happened to be in people's garages. And some of them were in parts and pieces. But so Steve Earle invited people down to Monterey to go racing, and thus was born vintage car racing. He had done it, and he ran the event authoritarianly, as well he should in very many ways. This is what he wanted to do. This is how he saw it. He would invite his people. If the car had provenance, then it could compete, and he had who he wanted to have. But of course, he had to contract with the racetrack. And I think that the time had come. People who belonged at SCRAMP, the sanctioning body of the racetrack, the 501c4 organization, said they wanted to go in a different direction. Or it was, and Bruce can talk to this because he's part of the group that is orchestrating the relaunch of the reunion and recasting it as the reunion. I still have a lot of time for Steve and Debbie Earle. They did a lot for this industry, and I look forward to seeing what it is that the reunion people can do to make it better.
Bruce, do you want to jump in there?
Sure. I mean, really, I don't think anybody at SCRAMP, none of us, think that anybody has done anything more important to vintage racing than Steve Earle. This was Steve's vision, and our intent is only to carry it on. Like anything, the times have changed, how things are done, and the economics of doing things, the cost of running an event like this just in the last 5 years have basically tripled. With you have county governments involved and traffic agencies and police entities, and all the costs that go with doing any event have just skyrocketed, and everybody wants their share. And it really was just kind of at a point where the track had to look hard at all the events it runs and how to make those events a little more organized and a little more current with the times as it relates to business. In terms of the cars and the people and all of that, there is no intent and never was an intent to change any of that, only to grow it and organize it, you know, a little differently. And all the things that Steve put in place, how the cars are picked in the beginning, and he's part of the selection committee, and some other great guys are on that selection committee. We have John Lamb from Road and Track, and we have Bill Warner, who runs the Amelia Island Concourse, and we have Jay Amestoy from Mazda, who's a great car guy. So we have a selection committee, and we did the same amount of effort that Steve's always done to make sure that all the cars were period correct cars with great history and great condition and owned by great people. And I mean great people that are, this event is about having fun. It's fun for the fans and the sponsors and the spectators alike and the participants. So none of that is changing. We are growing the event in terms of its size to some degree and its organization, because it really, this last year we've had probably 15 people working full time on this event and trying to do, you know, things that there wasn't the manpower or the wherewithal to do before. But this whole canvas is still what Steve created, and we're just continuing it on, you know, with another generation. It's like everything else.
Now, one of our listeners wants to ask about those ticket prices. I believe it's $150 if you do it online ahead of time, $175 on the day, not to mention things like $18 burritos once you get there and need to eat.
I honestly don't know what the ticket prices are. I don't think that's totally correct, but they haven't changed from a year ago. They went up,
myself. It's at the Concourse. But,
the Concourse,
you know,
it
has become, in general, a more expensive proposition, shall we say.
Yeah, but our tickets for 3 days, I believe, are less than if you go to a baseball game for 1 day for 4 hours. So, and you literally can come to this event and be there from 8 in the morning till 5:30 at night and see cars racing the entire day and cars in the paddock. This year there'll be 630 cars at the Monterey event that are being raced. And there'll be another 100 plus cars in the paddock that are old cool cars. Everything from Austin Healey Sprite to, you know, Ferrari Enzos will be in the paddock. We've reorganized the paddock. And then there's the car clubs and corrals in the infield are larger than ever with cars that a lot of cars that people have never seen before.
I wanted to ask David Love to just chime in here for a moment and talk about the thrill of racing a really old car. Have we lost you, David?
I'm here. I'm trying to collect my thoughts on that. I don't think it really doesn't matter what car you have that you want to use. Obviously, stepping from a Bugatti into a GT40 would be enough of a change to get your attention. But it's the fact that you can put yourself back in history. It's like a time machine. And the cars, the old cars, they were good ones and they were terrible ones. And they all held an interest. And it seems like no matter what shows up, if it's done correctly and with respect for the people who built it and used it, almost anything could be considered a classic car. And in order to enjoy it, you don't have to have kind of resources that you mostly see. It's, you know, the people who can afford to bring a whole transporter full of cars, everybody is the winner, because there are things there that we'd never see if somebody wasn't crazy enough to buy it and restore it for twice what they think it's worth, and not worry about whether it's going to be a toy or whether it's going to be an investment. And the idea of old cars as investments is something that I have a little trouble getting used to, because usually you are playing with these things for some unexplainable reason. I mean, if you have to ask why you do it, maybe you'll never be able to be understood.
With that, I want to give Dan Gurney the chance to give us a parting thought as we start to head towards the top of the hour.
Parting thought. Wow.
And to thank you as well for taking so much time with us today. We've really enjoyed it.
Well, it's a great pleasure, and I agree with what David just said, and it's a tough question to ask, but that's the reason that most of us are going there, and to be able to touch an era that is long gone is a huge privilege, and the sounds themselves, except for the whoosh that Dutch was talking about, is a great thing to hear. And I actually drove the Ford 999 once, and it was a huge time capsule experience. So I think that means a lot to a lot of the people that will be there this coming weekend.
Well, Dan Gurney, thank you again for joining us. Thanks again to our other guests, David Love, Bruce Canepa, and Dutch Mandel. Monterey prices, by the way, $50 on Friday, $70 on Saturday, $60 on Sunday, 12 and under, children 12 and under, rather, are allowed in for free. Form is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.